out in a few minutes. First, tell us what you found out about Tracy's movements on Saturday.
Turned out to be quite easy, said Cameron. He was in Sherbrooke at an art supply shop. Apparently that's where he gets most of his clay and other things he needs. His bank card shows a purchase there at 11:40.
Roughly the same time as the posts, said Cloutier. What did he buy?
A bag of clay, some glazes, said Cameron.
Gamache nodded. They'd found unopened clay wrapped in plastic and new pots of glaze in Tracy's studio.
I've also been to the local pharmacist about the abortion drug. She has no account for Vivian Godin or Carl Tracy and confirms the bottle is black market.
Why would Vivian need to get it on the black market? Asked Cloutier. She could get it for free, right?
With a prescription, oui, said Cameron. If you don't have one.
Or you want to terminate a pregnancy too far along, said Gamache.
Then you go on the black market to get the drug.
Mail order? Asked Gamache, and said a quiet prayer.
Many are, but the pharmacist didn't think so in this case. Buyers are beginning to realize that while pushers might not be the most reliable people, mail order is even worse. I know a few dealers, people we've dealt with in the past. Want to come?
Gamache looked in the direction of the holding cell where Godin waited. The abortion drug could be one of the keys to the case against Tracy, if it turned out he was the one who'd bought it. It could strengthen their arguments that he wanted to end the pregnancy, one way or the other.
No, there are other things I need to do.
But let me know as soon as you have any information.
Oui, patron,
said Cameron, pushing back from his desk.
Good.
Gamache brought out his iPhone. Give me your cell number. Cameron did. As Gamache was putting it in, his own phone vibrated with a call.
Excusez-moi.
He took a few steps away. Coroner's report is in, said Beauvoir. They found spores in her hand, an exact match for the ones on the rotten wood. Gamache exhaled. They'd just taken a big step closer to making an arrest. This proves she was on the bridge, said Beauvoir, and she died trying to save herself.
Oui, but we still need to place Tracy there and prove it wasn't an accident.
We're going over Tracy's clothes to see if we can find any of the microorganisms. The forensics team found something else, patron. When they moved her car, they found boot prints. They'd been protected from the rain by the car.
Are they a match for Tracy's boots? Asked Gamache.
They're looking now.
Good, good, said Gamache, his thoughts moving quickly ahead. Is it enough? Is it enough?
He made up his mind.
I'm going to hold Godin for another couple of hours until you find out more.
By then, we might have enough to nail Tracy. I think it's time we brought Pauline Vachon in.
Agreed.
I've applied for a warrant to search her place while she's being questioned, said Beauvoir. As soon as it comes through, I'll have her picked up. Isabel will interview her at the station. She'd like Cloutier there. Any news from your end?
Agent Cameron has a lead on the abortion drug found in Vivian's bag. Definitely black market. I'm hoping we can get proof that Tracy bought it.
About that, said Beauvoir, we have news on the fetus.
Gamache listened, his eyes narrowing as he absorbed the information.
When Beauvoir finished, Gamache simply said, Merci. What is it, patron? Asked Cloutier, seeing his expression after he'd hung up.
Gamache paused for a moment, staring at the blank wall in front of him. His lips were pressed together in concentration. Then he clicked his device off and slipped it into his pocket. Superintendent Lacoste will be by in a few minutes, he said, striding back to the desk. We're bringing in Pauline Vachon.
But there's more I can get from her private Instagram account, said Cloutier. I'm sure of it.
When he turned to her, she was surprised to see that the anxiety that had flitted across his face a few moments ago was gone, replaced by a smile. You've done a good job. It's only because of you we've found Madame Vachon and the pictures, and the damning messages. Chief Inspector Beauvoir feels we have enough, and I agree with him. Now the job will be to turn her. Pay attention to Superintendent Lacoste. Learn from her. She'll lead the interrogation. You'll be there to support.
It wasn't lost on either Cloutier or Cameron that he'd said interrogation, not interview.
They were almost there. They could see the finish line. It was just a matter now of dashing across it without falling.
And Homer?
Let Monsieur Godin know he'll be released soon. Agent Cameron, I'll come with you after all. Chief Inspector Beauvoir will meet us there.
Oui, patron.
As they made for the door, Cameron reached behind him to double-check that he had his gun. He knew he did, but best to be certain. Besides, touching it was a comfort. But he noticed, as he followed Gamache, that the Chief Inspector was not carrying a weapon. He wondered if he should say something, remind him that drug dealers were dangerous. But then he remembered who this man was, and what he'd seen, and what he'd done. Chief Inspector Gamache did not need to be schooled. He was the principal. Beauvoir stood at his desk in the incident room in Three Pines and checked his belt. The gun, as always, was there. He wondered if he'd feel naked going into work every day as a senior executive at the engineering firm in Paris without this accessory. Jean-Guy Beauvoir quite liked the feel of it, the heft, the ability to just pull back his jacket and expose it, to see people's eyes widen. The gun on his belt meant not simply safety, but power. Though just lately, something odd had begun to happen. It had felt heavier, more awkward, less natural. The gun had begun to feel foreign. Was this how it had started with Gamache? Surely, as a young agent, as an inspector even, he'd worn a gun. At what stage had he taken it off? When does a cucumber become a pickle? It was the question Gamache sometimes asked when contemplating human behaviour. And now Jean-Guy asked himself that. When does change occur? Change that is irreversible. At some point, guns had become, for Armand Gamache, a necessary evil, but still, and undoubtedly, evil. Gamache had knelt beside too many corpses, had made too many, had reached behind him and pulled the weapon from its holster, had swung it up, steadied his hand, pointed, and Armand Gamache had fired into another human being. Felt the recoil, smelled the discharge, seen the body drop, the person drop. Someone's son, daughter, husband, father. It was a terrible, terrible thing to have to do. Seeing the bullet strike was almost as bad as feeling it hit, as Jean-Guy knew too well. Being lifted into the air by the impact, the shock, the pain, the terror. That was almost as bad as seeing colleagues go down, gunned down. Seeing Gamache himself hit, lifted off the ground and collapse. Jean-Guy Beauvoir pushed that image, that memory, away, unable still to really face it. Face the fact he himself had done it once. Had seen Gamache through his sights and fired. Felt the report. Smelled the discharge. Seen him rise and watched him fall. It was the worst moment of Jean-Guy Beauvoir's life. And it had changed his life. His hand now closed briefly over the holster. But instead of feeling the usual reassurance, he felt a wave of revulsion. And he knew, in his gut, it was time to leave. He'd done his bit, done his best. Time to take a job where the only weapon was his mind, where there were no victims, only clients, and no suspects, only competitors, where everyone who started the day with a heartbeat ended the day with one. Or, if not, it wasn't his doing. But he wasn't there yet. Soon. Just this one last case. Jean-Guy Beauvoir just had to get across the finish line. Instead of answering Clara's question, why she'd never reviewed her shows, Dominica Oddly had hauled herself out of the sofa and was wandering around the studio, nodding as she took in the collection of stuff. A jumble of old works, failed and abandoned pieces sat beside finished and lauded portraits. There were stones and twisted tree roots, feathers and sticks and assorted broken eggs fallen from nests. It was as though Clara had left the door to her studio wide open and the wilderness had blown in. Audley took a deep breath and closed her eyes. The studio smelled of oil paint and turpentine and wet dog, and something else. Clara had given up trying to look sophisticated and had rolled off the low sofa onto her hands and knees, and now she got to her feet with a grunt. To Clara's horror, Audley had stopped in front of a collection of dusty ceramic pieces and was taking photographs.
"What do you call these?" she asked.
"Warrior uteruses." Audley laughed, a deep, rich, rumbling sound that filled the space with genuine amusement.
"Perfect. Have you shown them?"
"They're old. I did them maybe 10 years ago," Clara explained. "Showed them once."
"And?"
"Not a success." Audley nodded, clearly not surprised. Then she turned back to Clara.
"I've been to all your shows, you know, privately."
She walked over to the small portrait lounging against the wall, the one of Ruth. The old woman glared back at the young woman, her whole being filled with rage and pain, with bitterness and disappointment. Ruth gripped her worn blue shawl at her scrawny throat and looked out at a world that had left her behind.
"I didn't get it at first," Dominica admitted,
as though talking directly to the old woman.
"Didn't see what others saw. All I saw were portraits done in a predictable, conventional style. Granted, the subjects were interesting, but that struck me as a sort of cheat, a shorthand to cover up for a lack of technique, a lack of depth."
Dominica Audley turned away for a moment to look at Clara, and then returned her gaze to the portrait.
"I had my review all written, scathing. I especially hated her."
She lifted her chin toward Ruth, who clearly hated her right back.
"But something stopped me from publishing it. I decided to reserve judgment. I went to all your other shows and slowly, slowly began to see."
"See what?"
"That I was wrong. But more than that, I saw why. When I looked at your portraits, I saw the work of a middle-class, middle-aged white woman living in middle-of-nowhere Canada, working in a traditional, conventional medium. I was prejudiced. I couldn't believe that you, Clara Morrow, could come out of nowhere and possibly rock the art establishment. But you have."
She turned back to Ruth.
"This is the woman who contacted me about your work, right? Who convinced me to come here, isn't it? This is the poet, Ruth Zardo?"
"Yes." She nodded, her dreadlocks bouncing on her shoulders.
"Who hurt you once, so far beyond repair?"
She muttered the words of Ruth's most famous poem, then looked at Clara.
"You painted her as the Virgin Mary, the Mother of God, forgotten, bitter, filled with despair, which would have been amazing enough, without..."
She reached up her hand and pointed at a small white dot in the rheumy eye.
"That."
It was the smallest hint of light in a soul that had known too much darkness.
"No fraud could do that. Once I saw that, I revisited all your other paintings and saw what you were really doing. You're subversive, my friend, a sort of artistic agent provocateur, appearing to be one thing while actually being something else, something quite extraordinary, undermining all conventions. You don't just paint people, you capture them, make them give you their emotions. Not just despair and hope, but joy, hatred, jealousy, love, contentment, rage. How you managed to capture belonging is beyond me, but you did. The Three Graces? I actually wept. I stood in front of it, all alone in the gallery, crying. I still don't know why it made me cry." She turned to Clara. "Do you?"
"I don't know," she said quietly. "But I think you do." Dominica smiled and gave a single grunt of either laughter or recognition.
"I saw your latest exhibition," said Dominica, "in the cooperative collection of miniatures at the Brooklyn Art Space. Very generous of you, by the way, to agree to show with unknowns."
Clara closed her eyes briefly. This was it. Finally. She had what she wanted, needed. Dominica Oddly would tell the art world, all the naysayers and trolls and shits who'd turned on her, that they were wrong. Clara Morrow was a force within the art community. Clara Morrow would get her revenge.
Thank you, she said.
You must know how important this is to me. You've seen all the horrible things people have said on social media. My own home gallery is threatening to drop me. People are saying I'm a... What did you just call it?
A poseur. A fraud.
Yes, a fake. But a good review from you would change all that. Would stop all the attacks.
I've seen what they're writing, yes.
Then a thought occurred to Clara. Dominica was, for all her confidence, still young. Maybe she's afraid that if she voices a dissenting opinion, she'll lose credibility.
I have no problem telling it like it is, Oddly said, as though reading her thoughts. Going against popular opinion, it's one of my favourite things to do.
Then why haven't you posted? Why wait to defend me? Damage is being done.
Because I don't disagree.
Pardon?
Your miniatures are appalling, Clara. Trite, predictable, a blunder.
She turned back to the warrior uteruses.
I admire an artist for trying something different.
And then she looked at Clara again.
But your miniatures show not just a shocking lack of technique, but an almost insulting lack of depth, of effort. They're cowardly.
Clara stood stock still in her studio.
I was about to publish the review when Ruth Zardo's invitation arrived. I decided to wait until I saw you, until I had a chance to look you in the eye and thank you personally for your previous work and tell you how I feel about your latest. I think all those people posting are right. You're insulting those who once loved your work, who once supported you. You're insulting the art world. And worst of all, you've squandered, cheapened your talent, betrayed the gift you were given. And that's a travesty. No real artist would do that, could do that.
She brought a piece of paper out of her pocket.
Here.
As she held it out to Clara, she caught, again, that elusive scent. Below the oils, below the turpentine, the wet dog, the old bananas. It was lemon. Not the sour smell, but the fresh, sweet scent of lemon meringue pie. Clara reached for the paper, even as she felt the thrashing and heard the crunch of bones. Chapter 26. Catch this video. Sick. Hashtag Gamache sucks. Heard Odd about to post review of Morrow's stinkers. Finally. Hashtag Clara Morrow sucks. At Carl Tracy. Carl, trying to reach you. What's happening? Call me. Information was coming in quickly now. Sitting in his car on Rue Principale in Cowansville, Jean-Guy Beauvoir scanned the messages from his agents. Smiling, he clicked the phone closed and got out to join Gamache, who'd sent him the address and had just arrived himself outside the pizza joint. The boot prints match Tracy's, said Beauvoir, without preamble.
Bon, said Gamache. It's all coming together.
They're in there,
said Cameron, coming around the corner to join them. He pointed to an old low-rise apartment building.
Used to be a crack house, run by the mother of one of the kids. We busted her, but the kid now runs his own operation out of there. Not crack, but black market shit.
Kid? Asked Gamache.
Minor, 15. Name's Toby.
There was a character in a book Beauvoir read to his son every night named Toby. A mischievous boy with a pet balloon. Honoré found the adventures of Toby and his balloon hilarious. Jean-Guy found them strangely moving, as the boy struggled mightily to protect his vulnerable friend. And no matter what happened, to never let go.
He runs a gang of kids, dealing mostly prescription meds, painkillers, but other stuff too. We catch them, but they're on the street again in no time. Don't be fooled by their age.
We aren't, said Beauvoir. They followed Cameron into the building. The place reeked of damp and mould and rot. The chipped concrete stairs were sticky. They climbed up one flight, but just as Cameron stepped onto the landing, there was a sharp whistle and the sound of footsteps racing on the floor above.
Shit,
said Cameron, and ran up the stairs, taking them two at a time, followed by Gamache. Beauvoir, though, seeing where this was going, ran downstairs, out the front door, and into the side alley, scanning for the back door. There was a loud bang as a door flew open and kids piled out of the basement. Gamache and Cameron split up, chasing different kids down the hallways. Cameron cornered one in the stairwell leading to the roof.
Where's Toby?
Dunno.
He frisked her and came away with packets of foil and a switchblade. He cuffed her to the railing and moved on. Gamache chased another kid into an apartment where he tackled him, both of them falling onto one of the stained mattresses pushed together on the floor. Getting quickly to his feet, Gamache put the kid in a hold, patting him for weapons and scanning the room for other occupants. It was then he noticed pill bottles, neatly arranged on shelves lining all four walls.
Are you Toby?
The boy was silent. Gamache pulled a knife, a bottle of pills, and an ID from his pockets. Not Toby.
Where is he?
Beauvoir grabbed hold of the collar of the largest kid as he tried to escape down the alley and swung him around. Not a he, a she, a girl about 15.
Let her go,
came a voice from above. Beauvoir turned, still holding the girl, and saw a skinny kid on the fire escape, pointing a gun.
You a cop?
The kid asked.
Of course you are.
The girl yanked her jacket out of Beauvoir's grip and stepped away.
Toby?
Beauvoir asked the kid holding the gun.
Get his gun,
said Toby. The girl reached out, but Beauvoir backed away.
You don't want to do that.
Give her your gun, old man, said Toby.
Or what? You'll kill a cop?
Beauvoir looked at the large girl standing in front of him. Her eyes were wide, round. She was stoned and afraid. Then he looked at the kid on the fire escape and felt his heart leap in his chest. He was not afraid, not stoned. His grey eyes were empty, not cold, but not hot, not glaring, not even threatening. Chief Inspector Beauvoir had seen eyes like that, often, but only in the recently dead.
I'm a minor, said Toby. What are they going to do to me?
You know what they'll do to you, came a voice down the alley.
Toby immediately turned his gun on the older man walking toward them. His hands were out by his sides. His jacket was open to show he wasn't armed.
If you kill a cop, if you even hurt one, they'll try you as an adult. You're close enough, right? What are you?
Gamache turned his attention to the girl beside Beauvoir. 14? 15?
Almost 15, she said. Shut up, Daff,
said Toby, not moving the gun from the newcomer.
There's a third cop, you know, Daphne, said Gamache. Is that your name?
She gave a small nod.
If your friend shoots Chief Inspector Beauvoir,
he saw the girl's eyes widen even further, though Toby did not react. Gamache stopped where he was and addressed himself now to Toby.
That's right. Not just a cop, but Monsieur Beauvoir here is head of homicide for the Sûreté. If you shoot him, you'll have to shoot me too. And our colleague will almost certainly then have to shoot you. Both.
He let that sit there before speaking again, this time to Daphne.
Do you want to see 15?
I'm 15,
said Toby.
It's not so great.
No,
said Gamache. He'd also noticed the look, or lack of it, in the boy's eyes.
I don't suppose it is, and I'm sorry about that. But it can get better.
Just then Cameron rounded the corner, skidding in the slush as he tried to stop himself. Regaining his balance, he pulled out his gun, pointing it at first one, then the other kid, finally settling on Toby on the fire escape.
Put your weapon down, please, said Gamache.
And to everyone's astonishment, it was clear he was talking to Cameron.
You might keep it at the ready, but just lower it.
But
do it, said Beauvoir.
The girl, Daphne, had backed up and, quite sensibly, was now standing a few paces away from Chief Inspector Beauvoir. But Daphne was not the problem, nor was she the solution.
"We've come to ask you about a bottle of pills we found in a murder investigation," said Beauvoir. "Mifejimiso. It's an abortion drug. I know what it is. I know all the shit I sell."
"So you do sell it," said Gamache. "But probably not a lot." As he spoke, he moved a step closer to the fire escape, but away from Beauvoir, dragging Toby's attention and his gun toward him, forcing Toby to choose between them, making it more difficult for the boy to shoot both before Cameron could get off a shot.
"Stop," snapped Toby, before glancing at Daphne. "I said get his gun."
To Beauvoir's dismay, he felt his gun removed from its holster. This was, he knew, another reason Gamache never wore one. Because it could be taken, used against him, them, anyone and everyone. Most guns used in crime were stolen from people who had them legally. And here was one more on the street. Gamache looked over his shoulder at Cameron, warning him not to react, not to overreact. Nothing had happened yet. Not really. Nothing that could not be undone. But once a trigger was pulled, there was no going back.
"We need to know who bought the drug from you," said Beauvoir. "That's all."
His own voice was steady, matter of fact, trying not to betray the fear he felt, trying not to flash back to what it was like, to feel the bullet strike, to be lifted. He stopped there and fought to harness his thoughts.
"Then we'll leave."
Toby did what Beauvoir hoped he'd do. He turned his attention and his gun away from Gamache and onto him. What Toby could not see, what no one could see, was that Beauvoir's knees had begun to tremble. But his face remained placid, as though this were an everyday occurrence and nothing to worry about. Cameron, watching this, his weapon lowered but ready to raise and shoot, felt he was looking into some parallel universe, where people held reasonable conversations while pointing guns at each other, and were not terrified. Because he was very afraid, and Cameron knew one thing from his time on the gridiron and his time as a cop. People who were afraid often did very stupid things.
"Don't be the one, don't be the one, don't be the one to do something stupid. And please, please, don't let me be the one shot."
Gamache was very still, alert to any movement, anything that could trigger the boy with the empty eyes. The only comfort, if it could be called that, was that Toby would almost certainly get off only one shot before Cameron took him down. Still, by Gamache's calculations, there seemed a better-than-average chance at least one of them would die in that alleyway. He took another step away from Jean-Guy, forcing Toby's attention and weapon back onto him.
"Stop," said the boy. "Not another step. You think I won't shoot? You dumb fuck, but I will."
"I know you will, Toby," said Gamache. "But I hope you don't."
"We just want one thing," said Beauvoir. "The name of the person who bought the pills from you."
"You think I asked for his name? You're a fucking idiot."
His, thought both cops. His name. So Vivian hadn't bought the drug. A man had. Almost certainly Carl Tracy.
"Can you describe him?"
Beauvoir asked. They had to be sure.
"Are you kidding?
Look, the guys I sell to don't like it when I tell the cops on them."
"I can appreciate that," said Gamache. "My friends don't like it when I pass their address on to burglars." Daphne laughed, but Toby did not. Though he did cock his head with interest at the old cop with the grey hair and thoughtful eyes. He held those eyes for a moment, sensing something else in them. There was menace, for sure. Here was a man who might be old, but wasn't weak. And with a start, Toby recognized him. He wasn't just a cop. The fucker had failed to say he'd been the head of the whole Sûreté. Toby knew that because he'd seen the video that morning, posted on Twitter and going viral. Gamache noticed the change in the boy, saw a look come into those eyes. It was venal, feral, triumphant.
"My God," thought Gamache.
He's going to shoot me. He stared into the boy's eyes and thought of Renmarie, and silently apologized for what was about to happen. But what did happen was unexpected. Toby relaxed, just a little, but enough to get Gamash's heart going again.
Okay, old man. He was Anglo. Not fat, but soft. I didn't like him. Didn't trust him.
How many people do you trust? Toby gave one gruff laugh, but didn't answer.
I think we have enough, said Beauvoir. We're going to leave you now.
He slowly lowered his arms and held out his hand toward Daphne. This was the moment.
My gun, please.
Daphne looked up at Toby, who raised his gun slightly. Seeing this, Cameron raised his slightly, before Gamash could signal him to stop. Toby, alarmed, raised his gun more, until it was pointing at Beauvoir's head. Jean-Guy was staring straight down the barrel. Everyone froze. This was, Jean-Guy knew, a bullet he would not feel.
It's all right, said Gamash softly. No one needs to get hurt. We're almost done.
He stopped talking, allowing the tension to ease. He saw Toby's gun lowered, slightly. It was a millimeter in the right direction, but they weren't out of it yet.
Please, Gamash begged. Please don't let anyone come into the alley now. Please.
The moment stretched on, elongating. Gamash wanted desperately to say more, to try to reason with the boy, but he knew it would be a mistake. If they were to avoid a bloodbath, the next move had to come from Toby.
No,
said Toby.
My gun, said Beauvoir. You know I can't leave it behind.
Do you want to die, man? Shouted Toby. Get out, before I change my mind.
Oh, for God's sake, what are you doing?
Cameron's mind screamed.
Let's go. Oh, please, let's go.
And Jean-Guy Beauvoir wanted to. With every part of his being, he wanted to turn and walk away, run away, go back to Annie, hold her tight, smell the sweet, fresh scent of her, hold Honoré in his arms, get on a plane to Paris and never look back. But he couldn't go, couldn't let go. Not yet. Instead, he stood there, staring, willing the boy to see what he saw. They held each other's eyes. Finally, Toby spoke.
I'm fucked, aren't I? If I shoot, he'll kill me. If you leave without the gun, you'll be back to get it. You have to. You'll find us and arrest us, Daph and me.
That's true, said Beauvoir. He gave Toby a small nod of admiration, acknowledging the boy's logic and clarity.
So either I kill you all now, or I give up.
Oh, God, thought Cameron. Oh, God, here it comes.
Oui, said Beauvoir. That's about it. One, you live. One, you die.
Toby seemed to make up his mind. He braced. It was slight and too subtle for Cameron to see, but Gamash could, and he knew what it meant. Every muscle tightened, even as he realized there was nothing he could do. Toby was about to shoot Jean-Guy.
You know,
said Beauvoir, his voice remaining conversational, even as his knees threatened to give way.
I once faced exactly the same situation. Shut the fuck up. I'd reached the end. Couldn't go on. I didn't care anymore. Shut up! I thought about killing myself. But when it came down to it, I realized that what I really wanted was for the pain to stop. I didn't really want to die, but I didn't know how to live. How to go on.
There was silence then, utter, almost suffocating silence, as the air was sucked out of the alley.
What did you do?
I let go.
Beauvoir closed his eyes.
I let go.
Then he opened them again and met Toby's.
Sometimes we just have to let go and trust. There is a way back, believe me.
He smiled and opened his arms wide.
And look at the great place it brought me.
The words hung in the air of the void, before the boy laughed. Jean-Guy cocked his head. Toby, I don't want to die. And I don't think you do either. Toby closed his eyes, and while they could have moved, no one did. Then, eyes still shut, Toby let go of his gun.
Chapter 27. At Sûreté Crooked. I knew it. Cops killing kids. At Dumbass. You morons, that tape's doctored. Here's the real one. At Common Ground. At Sûreté Crooked. Can't we all just get along? At Sûreté Crooked. At Common Ground. Go fuck yourself.
Your name? Asked Superintendent Lacoste.
Pauline Vachon.
Your profession?
Web designer and manager. Do you know this man?
Isabel Lacoste placed a photograph on the metal table in the interview room. Lisette Cloutier sat off to the side, watching closely. Pauline Vachon was younger than she appeared in the Instagram pictures. Her hair was clean and nicely done, makeup carefully applied. She was pretty. Her clothes were simple, almost elegant, thought Cloutier. Black slacks and a white blouse, with a bright red silk scarf. Lacoste was also taking in Vachon's appearance. The makeup was cheap, clumping, and too heavily applied. The slacks were from a discount store, and the red scarf was rayon, masquerading as silk. And hiding, Lacoste could see, a coffee stain on the white blouse. Lisette Cloutier saw what she was meant to see. Isabel Lacoste saw the truth. Still, Lacoste knew that making the most of herself, on very little money, while holding together her own company at the age of 21, was far from criminal. In fact, it was remarkable. Pauline Vachon was a remarkable young woman, but she was also a nervous young woman. She clearly had not expected them to connect her to Tracy, and certainly not this quickly, and certainly not in any way that would lead her to be sitting in a Sûreté interview room. Beneath Pauline's calm, helpful veneer, Lacoste could sense alarm, barely suppressed, but suppressed. This was indeed a self-possessed young woman. So why had she hooked up with the mess that was Carl Tracy? That was just one of the many questions that came to mind. Pauline sat upright in the interview room, almost prim, and looked down at the photo on the metal table.
Yes, he's one of my clients. Carl Tracy.
And what do you do for him?
I set up his website and manage his social media.
Which platforms?
Instagram, mostly.
Can you give us the address of his website and social media accounts?
Cloutier wrote it down, though, of course, she already knew it. Vachon did not volunteer the private account.
Many followers? Lacoste asked.
Not really. I tried to tell him that you need to post a lot to get interest. But honestly, what can a potter post that could go viral? More pictures of a lump of clay on a wheel?
Lacoste smiled.
I sympathise. Unreasonable clients. The worst.
Pauline relaxed a little.
He's not really that bad. He just doesn't understand.
You post for him? She nodded.
Why doesn't he do it himself?
Asked Lacoste. These were softball questions. Every interrogator had a particular technique. Hers was to set people at their ease, have them lower their defences.
He's an artist, not great at technical things. Besides, there's no internet at his place. Can you tell me what this is about?
It interested Lacoste that it had taken this long for Pauline Vachon to ask. It was normally the first question out of anyone's mouth, but then this young woman already knew the answer.
Has something happened to Monsieur Tracy?
She looked directly into Lacoste's eyes, not blinking. Brown eyes, all innocent with just the right touch of curiosity. Without, it would appear, guilt or guile.
I'm afraid his wife has drowned, and we just have some questions. Oh, that's terrible.
Pauline looked from Lacoste to Cloutier and back again.
Yes, said Lacoste. Did Monsieur Tracy ever talk about his wife?
Vachon paused to gather her thoughts, to sort through the truth and lies and decide which to choose.
A bit. He didn't seem happy. He said she drank, was depressed. I felt sorry for him.
Pauline,
said Lacoste, leaning forward a little and dropping her voice so that it sounded as though she were about to confide in the young woman.
I really hope you don't mind, but I'm going to ask you some questions that might seem odd. Is that all right?
Sure, of course. She looked at her watch. I have an appointment in an hour.
Oh, this won't take that long. Don't worry, said Lacoste with a motherly smile, despite the fact there weren't that many years between them. It wasn't years, but choices that separated these two women.
How old was your mother when she had you?
Both Vachon and Cloutier looked at her with surprise.
You weren't kidding about the strange questions,
said Pauline with a laugh, though she was slightly guarded now.
She was 16.
Young.
Must have been difficult. And your grandmother? How old was she when she had your mother? Do you really need to know this? What does this have to do with Carl's wife?
Cloutier had the same question and just barely stopped herself from nodding agreement.
I'm sorry, said Lacoste, and looked it. I just need your help understanding some things about this community. How judgmental it can be of young women.
It was a vague answer, but seemed to satisfy, mollify Pauline.
My grandmother was 15.
And you're 21?
Yes. How old were you when you first got pregnant?
That hovered between the two women.
Why? Please, Pauline. It would help a lot.
Cloutier could see that Vachon realized she'd created a problem for herself. She'd offered to help, needed to appear willing to help. And these questions were not, on the surface, threatening or even, it must be admitted, pertinent. But they were deeply invasive.
I was 16.
And what happened?
I had an abortion.
The next time? Now Pauline shifted in her seat.
Why are you asking this? It's not illegal. It was all done by a doctor in a hospital.
Yes, I know. But I also know that small towns can be supportive, but they can also be pretty awful.
You get a reputation. Nasty rumours spread. Rumours with just enough truth in them to do damage.
People don't always like it when you're a success, do they?
Not always,
Pauline said, lifting her chin slightly. Isabel Lacoste found herself admiring this young woman, who refused to give in. She had guts, but did she have a conscience?
No, said Lacoste quietly. They're not always as kind as we'd like. Especially painful when friends aren't happy for you. You're trying hard to get out, to make a career for yourself, to make a success of your business, get a little money, and people are all, oh, she's too good for us now, just because you dress nicely and take some care, right?
Pauline nodded, but was guarded, though not as guarded as she should have been.
Can I tell you something? Lacoste lowered her voice. Something no one else outside the police knows.
Pauline nodded, leaning forward.
Vivian was pregnant. That's why I'm asking. But we don't really know who the father was. Really? Got it,
whispered Pauline.
Poor Carl. Yes, poor Carl. Who can blame him for wanting out of that marriage?
Lacoste leaned back in her chair, her voice once again businesslike.
Now, the second time you were pregnant, another hospital procedure? D&C, yes. And the third time?
There was now, in Lacoste's tone, a slight edge, not of judgment, but of warning. Tell the truth.
How did you end that pregnancy, Pauline?
I know who you are, said Toby, sitting at a desk in the station, not all that far from where Lacoste was interviewing Pauline.
You're the cop everyone hates, said Daphne.
She was at the next desk over, also being booked. Gamache smiled. Not everyone, I hope.
Everyone I know.
Gamache was not particularly surprised to hear that teens running a criminal operation might not be fans.
I saw the video of you killing those kids, said Toby. Brutal.
Cameron, the arresting officer, stopped typing on his computer. Jean-Guy Beauvoir, sitting nearby and going over messages, looked up. And Armand Gamache tilted his head slightly, the smile fading.
What video?
Toby laughed.
You haven't seen it? Posted about an hour ago. Gone viral. Funny that I watched it. Then there you were.
Gamache drew his brows together. There was a video out there of him gunning down children. How could that be? He turned to Jean-Guy, who still looked pale after that confrontation in the alley. As they'd driven back, Gamache had noticed Beauvoir trembling and quietly asked if he was okay.
I didn't think I'd get out of there alive,
Jean-Guy said under his breath. Gamache thought the same thing, but didn't say it. He still felt the acid burning his stomach. You'll be on the Champs-Élysées soon, he'd said, in the sunshine.
Not soon enough.
While Jean-Guy knew Paris wasn't immune to danger, it would at least be unlikely. There was a far better chance of returning home each day. Now, on hearing what Toby said, Jean-Guy swung around to his laptop, hitting the keys. Sûreté, video, kids, Gamache, video, shooting.
I could have shot you, you know, said Toby. Payback, for what you did.
Why didn't you? Toby sat back and crossed his arms.
You weren't worth a bullet, and you sure aren't worth dying for. He'd have killed me.
He nodded to Cameron, who was staring at the boy.
You got that right, said Cameron.
Toby turned back to the older man with the grey hair and that nasty scar by his temple that made him so recognisable. The cop's face wasn't so much wrinkled as lined. From a great distance, from half a century away, he looked to the boy like a man broken and pieced back together. Humpty Dumpty, who'd had a great fall.
Patron,
said Beauvoir from the other desk, breaking into Toby's thoughts. His voice was hushed, almost a whisper. Annie was working from home in Montreal, studying for the French law admission exams. A friend from her firm in Montreal had sent a link and a warning. But of course, she had to look. Clicking on it, she watched, blood draining from her face. Honoré, on her knee, was also watching, but she quickly took him away, placing him in his playpen. Then she returned to her laptop, approaching it warily. The screen was paused on an image of her father. Her eyes were wide, her breathing shallow. She muted the sound and hit play. Reine-Marie covered her mouth with her hand and closed her eyes. The bruise on her face forgotten, she now felt as though she'd been hit, hard, in the gut. Then, opening them again, she asked Myrna to go back to the beginning.
Are you sure? Myrna asked.
They'd gone up to Myrna's loft over the bookstore, where the internet was most stable. Annie had sent the link. She knew that her mother would want to know, to be warned about what was out there. In the few minutes it had taken the women to get upstairs, more and more messages had come in from friends who were alarmed and upset, who wanted to warn both her and Armand. Myrna and Clara were in the loft with her, as were Olivier and Gabri. Ruth was sitting beside her in front of the computer, her veined hand holding Reine-Marie's.
Please,
said Reine-Marie. Myrna clicked, and the short video played again. Do you mind if we use your meeting room? Beauvoir asked the station commander, who, on seeing him at her door, clicked her computer closed and reddened, but not before Beauvoir had heard the telltale sound of muffled gunfire coming from her laptop.
Not at all.
Beauvoir closed the door to the private office and placed his laptop on the table. Gamache stood beside him, staring at the frozen image on the screen. It was of himself in flak jacket, weapon out and raised, eyes sharp, preparing to shoot.
It's bad, said Beauvoir.
Gamache nodded.
Go on.
He stood straight and faced the screen, much as he'd faced the boy on the fire escape earlier that day. Beauvoir hit play. The images were jerky, but still fairly clear. It had been pieced together from old video, taken from the raid on the factory. They were images both Gamache and Beauvoir had seen before, many taken from the cameras they themselves had worn. But there were other images, ones neither had ever seen. Video culled from God knew where on the internet, of kids being gunned down, many of them black kids, clearly unarmed. As Armand Gamache watched the screen, Beauvoir watched him, saw the narrowing of the eyes, the wincing at the terrible images. The video had been edited to make it appear that Gamache was responsible for all of it. The editing was rough, not really designed to fool anyone, except those who wanted to be fooled. As Jean-Guy Beauvoir watched Gamache, he realized he'd never seen anyone actually gutted before. Until now. Madeleine Toussaint sat at her desk with her second-in-command and watched the video. Her email, her phone lines had lit up, all guiding her to this travesty. She watched it 3 or 4 times.
"What are you going to do?" her second-in-command asked. "There has to be a response. The Sûreté has to condemn."
"I know what has to be done. Leave me."
After a moment, she added,
"Please."
When alone, Chief Superintendent Toussaint got up and walked over to the wall map. It showed the current flooding, of which there was a lot, and more to come. But her eyes rested on the massive hydroelectric dams. Without her consent, without her knowledge, the floodgates had been opened. And, more, the resources had been diverted south. Runoffs had been dug, were still being dug, river levels lowering. There was collateral damage to farms and fields, but most farmers not only understood, but had helped. Toussaint accepted the congratulations from the Prime Minister for her handling of the situation, smart enough not to acknowledge it hadn't been her doing. She herself had still been considering the options when she'd been told there were no more options. The decision had been made, an irreversible action had been taken, and she suspected by whom. She looked across her vast office at the image on the screen of the former occupant gunning down black teens. Some, she realized with horror, not even that old. She felt sick, physically ill. They could be her own son. Yes, something had to be done about Gamache. Something more than what she'd already done. Madeleine Toussaint sat back down and composed her response. Then, before she could regret it, she hit send. Reine-Marie was sitting in Myrna's kitchen with a shot of scotch, talking with Annie on the phone while the others huddled together, conferring. All except Ruth, who'd returned to the computer, drawn back like a compass to magnetic north to the unimaginable violence done to those children, done to Armand. Reine-Marie, phone to her ear and listening to Annie vent, watched as Ruth clicked away on the keyboard, her bony fingers thudding the keys as though punishing the computer for its complicity. Then, with a final flourish, the old woman hit one last key and sat back, smiling.
"Annie, I have to go," said Reine-Marie.
"I need to call Reine-Marie," said Armand, reaching for the phone. "I'll call Annie."
Jean-Guy got through, but Armand did not. After trying home, then the bistro, he finally reached her at Myrna's.
"I saw it," said Reine-Marie, before he'd even spoken. "Don't worry. No one believes it. It's crude."
"It's cruel," came a voice shouted in the background. "But I fixed it."
Ruth, Armand recognized.
How did she fix it?
Armand? It was Jean-Guy's voice. He had Annie on the line and was sitting once again at his laptop.
"Hold on," said Armand. And he turned to his son-in-law. "What is it?"
"Annie sent me a link, just posted."
"The same one?" Armand began to ask as he walked around to the laptop. But he stopped, walking, talking, breathing.
The image frozen on the screen was clearly from the same raid on the factory. But this was a different video. It was, he could see immediately, from the original recording. The true record of what had happened that day. It was never meant to be made public, never meant to be seen outside the Sûreté and the official inquiry. But the video had been leaked and posted years ago, in a violation so profound it had taken Gamache, Beauvoir, the families, years to get over. Scenes had obviously been taken from it to create the bastardized video that had gone up that morning. Armand now knew how Ruth had fixed it. Thinking she was helping a friend, she'd reposted the original, in hopes of showing the truth. What the old poet didn't realize, or had forgotten, was that social media was less about truth than perception. People believed what they chose to believe. Neither did she appear to understand the damage she'd just done.
"I have to let you go," Armand said into the phone.
When he hung up, he looked briefly at the clear image on the screen, taking one deep breath after another, trying to control his outrage. Then, reaching for the phone, he said to Jean-Guy, "Can you give me a few minutes?" Jean-Guy stepped toward the door, paused, then turned around. He knew what Armand was about to do.
"No."
"No?"
"I'm staying with you."
He sat down. There would be no argument. Jean-Guy did not leave his side as Armand called the families of the officers who'd been slain that day, whose deaths, like some horrific snuff film, were once again played out in public. Armand placed call after call. They were numbers he knew by heart, since he spoke to the mothers, fathers, husbands and wives every week and visited the families whenever he was invited. Now he called to warn them, to listen to their rage, to absorb, again, their agony. When he'd finished, he asked Jean-Guy to leave him, just for a couple of minutes. And this time Jean-Guy did. When he was alone, Armand sat quietly, then dropped his face into his trembling hands. "Things are strongest where they're broken," the young voice reassured him. And Armand gasped with pain as he held the agent, no more than a boy, in his arms. Chapter 28.
"Some abortion drug."
Those were Pauline Vachon's words. Too ashamed to go back to her doctor, she'd gone where desperate women had for centuries, into a back alley. But this time it wasn't some sadist with a coat hanger. It was a kid with a pharmacy.
"Mifepristone?" Lacoste asked. "Maybe. I don't know. I just took it. And it worked." "Is that how Carl Tracy knew about it?"
There was silence, except for the ticking of the old clock on the wall, as the reality of what they were really talking about hit Pauline.
"I was just trying to help a client. Nothing wrong with that."
Lacoste remained silent.
"His wife was pregnant,"
Vachon went on.
"He said it probably wasn't his, that they hadn't had sex in months. So I told him about the drug."
"And where to get it?"
"Yes."
"You knew he was going to give it to her, probably without her knowledge, and that was fine with you?"
"What he did with it was his business."
Lacoste struggled not to show her disgust, at Tracy, but also at this alarming young woman who didn't seem to see anything wrong with this.
"It didn't work," said Lacoste.
"Vivian was still pregnant when she died."
"She couldn't have been. This was last summer," said Vachon.
Isabel Lacoste's mind raced. It seemed they were talking about two different pregnancies. Carl Tracy had ended one with the abortion drug last summer, but now Vivian was pregnant again. Had she suspected what he'd done? Was that one of the reasons, perhaps the main reason, she'd decided to finally get out now, so the same thing didn't happen to this child?
"Well, she was," said Lacoste, "pregnant."
"You didn't know?"
"I didn't know him all that well. He didn't tell me everything."
"You knew him well enough to set up an illegal drug buy, well enough to help him abort the baby without his wife's knowledge, well enough to sleep with him." Lacoste opened the file in front of her and removed the photographs, taken off the private feed. She placed them, one at a time, on the table. Pauline was momentarily taken by surprise, but then recovered herself. With speed rarely seen by Lacoste, she grasped the situation and made a decision.
"I'm not exactly picky, am I?"
said Pauline, smiling. Lacoste realized she'd underestimated this young woman and how remarkable she really was. This was strategic. Mix truth in with lies, so it became more and more difficult to tell them apart.
"It meant nothing," Pauline explained. "Might not have been the smartest thing I've done, having sex with a client, but hey, people have done worse."
"Like murder," said Lacoste. There could be no more doubt about the relationship between Tracy and Vachon, and neither was there any doubt about the relationship between interviewer and interviewee. One was in charge, the other in trouble. Pauline Vachon looked down at the photographs, her lips compressing.
"How did you get these?"
"You've been corresponding with Nouveau Galerie, I believe," said Lacoste.
"You?"
said Vachon, looking first at Lacoste, then at Cloutier, who gave a curt nod. The clotted makeup could not conceal the panic in her face. Lacoste opened the file again and read, "Stuff's in the bag. Everything's ready. We'll be done tonight, I promise." That was a message from Carl Tracy to you around noon on the day Vivienne disappeared. And your reply? Look, I had nothing to do with it. Finally, good luck. Don't mess it up. She looked up from the file. But he did, didn't he? He messed it up royally. That's why you're here, Pauline. The younger woman was flushed, but she tried one more twist to get off the hook. Those were about the clay Tracy was buying. He was going to do more pieces that night. I told him not to mess it up. He'd been promising some for weeks. Lacoste got up. I'll let you think about what you just said. Unless something happens in the next few minutes, like a meteor strikes, you'll be charged with the murder of Vivien Gaudin. She and Cloutier left the room, leaving the file behind. We have her, said Lacoste, walking up to Beauvoir, who was standing outside the meeting room. Pauline Vachon doesn't admit to being part of the murder, yet, but she will. I'm letting her stew for a few minutes. She was clearly shaken when she realized we'd seen the private account.
You should have seen her face, said Cloutier.
Lacoste nodded. She admits she used the abortion drug herself and was the one who told Carl Tracy how to get it on the black market. How Lacoste got the young woman to admit to a third abortion, never mind buying the black market drug, still amazed Cloutier. It had been a masterful combination of guile, of guesswork, of knowing when to push and when to make nice, until Vachon had nowhere to go but the truth. Cloutier was looking at Lacoste with something close to awe, but there was caution there as well. She did not want to make the same mistake as Vachon. Whether by natural instinct or honed skills, Isabel Lacoste had the power to see things people wanted to hide. And they all had them, as Lisette Cloutier knew only too well. But while Cloutier was focused on Lacoste, Lacoste was focused on Beauvoir.
What is it?
He told them about the video. Before Lacoste could react, the door opened and Gamache stepped out. He was pale, but composed. Every agent in the open room looked over at him. They'd all read the Twitter feed and seen the doctored video that was blowing up online. They had yet to see the real video that had just been posted.
What can we do, Petro?
Lacoste asked, going to him and touching his hand. There's nothing to be done. Merci, Isabel. I've spoken to the families. His smile was tight and his voice brisk. How did the interview go with Pauline Vachon? As they returned to the meeting room to talk privately, both Lacoste and Beauvoir noticed that Gamache's right hand was closed into a tight fist, but still it trembled. They watched on the monitor as Pauline Vachon turned the folder around and went through the photographs and printouts. Then she sat back in her chair and stared at the far wall. Seeing, Lacoste knew, all her work, all her dreams, dissolving. Then Beauvoir closed the feed on his laptop and turned to Lacoste. Tell us what happened. When Lacoste finished, Beauvoir thought for a moment. She'll crack.
I'm not so sure, said Lacoste. She's clever and she's tough. Makes me so angry. She really could have made something of her life. I still don't know why she'd hook up with Carl Tracy.
She saw a shortcut, said Beauvoir.
To what? An abusive relationship in a remote farmhouse? Not exactly Cinderella.
She probably thought she was smarter, tougher than Vivien Gaudin, said Beauvoir. That she could control Tracy.
We saw the bruises on her arms, said Cloutier. She must know.
Maybe she does. Maybe it's the cycle of abuse, right, Patron? Said Beauvoir, and Gamache nodded. Beauvoir and Lacoste exchanged glances, but said nothing. They'd give him time and space to return to them. Beauvoir sat forward, his voice all business. The coroner's report came in. The fetus, a baby girl, was his.
His who?
Asked Lacoste, needing to be absolutely clear. Carl Tracy. The baby was his.
You're kidding.
It was, of course, rhetorical. Isabel Lacoste sat back in her chair. What did this mean?
Do you think Vivian knew this and was messing with Carl when she told him it wasn't his? She asked. Or did Vivian really believe the baby was someone else's?
We only had Tracy's word on it that she said anything, Beauvoir pointed out. I think that's bullshit. Her father said she was desperate to get out as soon as she could that day. Why would she provoke Tracy by saying anything?
What did Pauline Vachon say about the messages on the private Instagram? Gamache asked, speaking for the first time in the meeting. How did she explain them?
Said they were about clay he was buying.
Gamache frowned. Smart. She's quick on her feet.
She is that, agreed Lacoste. This might not be as easy as we'd hoped.
But she must know no one in their right mind would believe that, said Beauvoir. Not after what happened.
Do you get the impression she cares for Tracy? Gamache asked.
Not especially, said Lacoste. I think she has sex with him for the same reason she has sex with so many other men. It's a form of self-loathing.
What role do you think she has in all this? Gamache asked.
I don't know, but I can tell you she's involved. And she knows we know.
What do you think would happen if you told her the baby was Tracy's? Beauvoir asked.
Lacoste considered that.
It'd be a surprise, a shock. Not because she loves Tracy, but it would prove to her that he lied about that. He can't be trusted.
Exactly, said Beauvoir, sitting forward. She's smart. She must realise that he'd blame the killing on her in a second if he was cornered.
So we need to press that home, said Lacoste. She must be thinking about it even now. This information about the fetus might be just that last shove we need.
Give it another go, Isabel, said Beauvoir. Try to turn her. We have enough now to arrest him, but her testimony would secure a conviction.
Lacoste gave one curt nod.
Leave it to me.
I'll apply for an arrest warrant for Tracy, but we'll wait to hear from you. Even if you can't turn her, we'll bring him in. He'll crack, even if she won't.
She will, said Lacoste. I'll make sure of it.
Clara Morrow dropped the printout onto the bistro table and sat down across from Dominica Oddly.
Do you really think this?
I do.
You say here, she tapped the paper, that I was once promising, exceptional even, but then I got lazy.
Yes.
But it's not true.
No, asked Oddly. Are you sure?
The critic had left Clara in her studio to read in private the review that had just gone public. She'd strolled across the village green and, brushing slush off the bench, she sat, looking at the three pine trees that clearly gave the place its name. It seemed a little on the nose for Oddly. Too obvious. Three pines in three pines. She'd have preferred it if there were two pines. It would make the place more interesting, give it a story. What happened to that third tree? Granted, not much of a story, but better than none. As it was, this hidden little hamlet was pretty, but banal. She could almost see the stone and brick and clabbered homes, the church on the hill and the forest behind, turning into a watercolour before her eyes. Something not quite real, not quite of this world. Certainly not of the gritty, noisy, aggressive world she'd just left. This was like a pretty painting by some elderly, marginally gifted artist. Nice, sweet, predictable, safe. Oddly smiled as she thought of the residents peering through their curtains at the wild black woman in dreadlocks and combat boots sitting in the middle of their peaceful village. She must, she thought, scare them to death. She'd spotted the bistro when she'd arrived, and now she made for it. Her boots, veterans of sidewalk garbage and dog shit, squelched on grass and mud. She opened the door and was prepared to enter a space decorated with grand-mère in mind, all lace and gingham, stuffed with old snowshoes and spinning wheels and dusty twig baskets filled with dried flowers hanging from the rafters, furnished with cheap imitation pine tables and uncomfortable chairs. If Oddly knew one thing about Quebec, it was that it was a cheap imitation of the real thing, France. Instead, what she found was a place both contemporary and somehow ageless. It seemed to straddle the centuries.
comfortable armchairs, upholstered in fresh linens, sat around an assortment of rugged old tables, dark oak, maple, pine, tables made from the forests that surrounded the village. They were scratched and dented and worn by a century or more of meals, of drinks, of companionship, and hardship. The place settings, displayed in an old Welsh dresser, were white china with clean modern lines. Oriental rugs, hand-tied, were scattered on the wide plank floors. The walls were freshly plastered and painted a shade that contrasted nicely with the warm wood and stone. She looked up. Nothing hung from the sturdy beams. The bistro smelled of rich coffee and subtle maple smoke from the fieldstone fireplaces at either end of the room. It was a place of confidences, of companionship, where secrets were exchanged and yearnings admitted, where children grew into adults, into seniors, where homecomings were celebrated and lives celebrated by those left behind. It was a place where both grandmother and granddaughter would feel at home.
"Bonjour," said a young woman coming from behind the long bar to greet her. "Une table, c'est votre choix?"
She smiled at Dominica, as though dreadlocked New York critics were their regular customers, and pointed to the near-empty room. It was mid-afternoon, between rushes. The few other customers had glanced at her, then gone back to their conversations, showing little interest and no fear.
Said Audley, not at all sure what the young woman had said.
"Oh, sorry, English, sit anywhere you like. The fireplace has just come open. I'll clean the table for you."
The young woman spoke in slightly accented English. As Audley followed her to the large armchair by the fire,